Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, June 9th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson from Moscow is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Oh, hi there.
Larry, let's get started with the latest news from Russia that Sergei Lavrov said that the British government is totally involved with what has happened, these terrorist attacks on Russia. And how do you find the atmosphere there and the way that they're talking about these attacks on nuclear bombers and on bridges and in the Kursk region and in Bryansk?
Well, while, you know, Vladimir Putin and his government, they, you know, they mentioned in particular the attacks on the bridges. First, the bridge in Kursk, and then the bridge in Bryansk, which also fell on an incoming train. I always like to remind people that compared to the attack on Crocus City Hall, those were relatively minor attacks, because in Crocus City Hall attack a year ago, March, it killed over 145 people, I believe, and wounded over 341. So it was really a horrific human casualty toll. But I think the real concern for Russia was the escalation in terms of the attack on the air bases and what they call the strategic triad. So they're going after these strategic bombers. Although the drone attacks did minimal damage, it was still more the principle that the fact that not only would Ukraine do it, but Ukraine did it with the backing, almost certainly the backing of the United Kingdom and the backing of the United States. So that, you know, that remains an object of great concern in Russia. And that's why if you listen carefully to Vladimir Putin, he described this now as a counterterrorism operation. Up to this point, the war has been conducted as a special military operation, not as a counterterrorism operation. And what that means by transitioning it to a counterterrorism operation means that Ukrainian leadership can now be targeted. Previously, Putin had no intention at all of killing Zelensky or Budanov or Syrsky, but now I would argue that those gentlemen are definitely on a target list. And Russia is going to be much more lethal in dealing with that threat.
And that's going to be a direct attack on somewhere, I don't know, strategic to the Ukrainian government, or they're going to attack some, they're going to consider some sort of solution or some sort of response to what has happened on the battlefield?
No, I think this will, I think you're going to see attacks on government headquarters and buildings in Kiev that previously have been left untouched. Russia's response is going to be broad. It's going to be comprehensive. I suspect they're going to take out electrical grids as well. They're going to make a concerted effort to turn the power off to Ukraine. And then also to militarily damage it to the point that it can't be repaired.
And how about the talks between Russia and Ukraine? How do they feel about these talks that have happened? And right now, maybe the next round, nobody knows when would be the next round of negotiations. But so far, what is the perceptions on the part of Russians with the talks with Ukrainians?
Well, right now you still have the situation where Ukraine has not even fulfilled its part of the deal. You know, they were supposed to accept the 6,000 cadavers of soldiers that have died on the battlefield. So Russia has recovered their bodies, identified them using DNA, and Ukraine continues to refuse to accept those bodies. And one of the reasons is it forces Ukraine to admit that their casualties are far, far higher than they've admitted in the past. And then secondly, Ukraine will be on the hook to pay the families, the survivors of those dead soldiers, a significant amount of money that frankly Ukraine doesn't have. So you know, at this point, Russia will continue to negotiate and deal with Ukraine on, let's call it the technical level, these working delegations. But in terms of broad level peace negotiations, I don't see that going anywhere.
Do they feel really the attack was was implemented by the British and the British intelligence, or they see some sort of link with the United States as well? What is the general sense, the general opinion on that?
You mean that in Russia, the general opinion?
They feel about it? It's all about the British, or they see something beyond that?
No. I think the Brits have earned themselves a lot of enmity, and Russia is not at all happy about it. But Russia is not going to strike militarily inside the United Kingdom. But if they can identify any targets inside Ukraine that are involved British soldiers or British advisors being based there, I fully anticipate Russia to hit those and kill some Brits.
How do you compare? Last time you were in Moscow, it was 5 months ago, 6 months ago. When was
3 months?
Three months ago.
The first of March. What I did notice yesterday, when I arrived at my hotel, I saw four different groups, two-man groups of soldiers with rifles in uniform, creating a security perimeter. I don't know if there was a VIP in the area or what. When I went out this morning, I didn't see that. But again, seeing that yesterday was something I had never seen before in Moscow or St. Petersburg. So, you know, clearly there are, the Russians are on a much higher security footing now because of the terrorist attacks. And, they're not taking it lightly.
How do you feel about being in Russia? I think with the Russian media, you can feel the way that the public opinion, or maybe those people who are more radical toward the conflict in Ukraine, are putting pressure on the government, on the Putin administration. Do you feel that? Do you feel these people are getting a stronger voice in Russia?
No, it is like this conference I'm attending. It's the forum on the future, looking 25 years ahead. I can't tell you how rewarding it is to talk. The number of young people younger than you, kid, that come up to me and they want the picture with the old man. To listen to them, some of them are entrepreneurs. They're in advanced studies. What an incredible future, Russia has. And if you needed therapy to feel good about the world, this is it. Energized by it. What's been fun is I'm here with George Galloway. George is here with his wife and son. The father of Elon Musk, Errol Musk, is here. And I've had a chance to visit with him, great gentleman. So we've got all of us old guys, but there are a lot of, and I'm talking people in their late teens, early 20s. And again, a number that speak English with impeccable English. It's really rewarding.
As you've mentioned here today, Sergei Lavrov said that there is a real and growing terrorist threat coming from Ukraine, and Russia will take all necessary measures to eliminate it. How do you think that, Larry, as time goes by with the conflict in Ukraine and with the desperation on the part of not only the Zelensky administration, but also Europeans, you look at today, you look at the new president of Poland. He's so much hawkish about what's going on in hawkish toward Russia. But how do they feel the future? How do they want to continue the way that it is right now? Do they have any sort of solution in the near future? What do they feel about it?
You mean the Russians?
I'm talking about the Russians, the way that we know that Europeans want the continuation. How does Russia sees? Are they looking for a buffer zone, a military buffer zone, then go after a political buffer zone?
Well, I was talking actually with one of the descendants of the Romanovs. So he is great cousins was the king, the Tsar, who was killed back in 1917, 1918. As he pointed out, he says, we've got so much land in Russia that is not occupied. We don't need to go to some other country to try to take land. You know, who needs the headache of being responsible for Poland or Romania or Hungary? So this notion that Russia is bent on conquering Europe or invading Europe is just, it's ridiculous. It makes absolutely no sense. Russia is actually trying to come up with policies to encourage young couples to have more children. They want to repopulate Russia, and there's plenty of land. When you consider how vast the Russian territory is. So to that extent, you know, the Russians look, they're really puzzled by the irrational hatred that comes out of Europe. Because it'd be one thing if the Russians were wantonly killing civilians, which they're not. If nothing, you fault Putin for being overly cautious in his war against Ukraine to limit civilian casualties. And there is pressure in Russia for the Russian military to accelerate, to do more. So I have to see how all of that pans out.
The conference you're attending right now, Larry, the conference is about the future of the conflict in Ukraine. What is the main goal of
the future of Russia?
Future.
The future of Russia and the future, of the world. So there's a little bit of talk about, for example, one session dealt with what does the war in Ukraine teach us about the future of modern war? Because clearly the combination of intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance capabilities, coupled with drone technology, coupled with hypersonic missiles, really has changed the battlefield. It has changed the way that, how war is even conceptualized. There are talks about, how to build the future of Russian society, having more children, and continue with the innovation in the economy. Russia is a pretty dynamic, vibrant place right now. Really, gives reason for a lot of hope. And we just, we wish the Europeans and Americans would come to their senses and stop figuring out how they can destroy Russia. Because Russia is not trying to figure out how to destroy the world. It's very much dedicated to, building a new world order, a new world economic order with China, India, South Africa, Brazil, and other countries that comprise BRICS.
Larry, is there anybody from the Russian army explaining the transformation of the Russian army during the conflict in Ukraine?
No, not yet. I haven't Actually, I'm supposed to have a meeting tomorrow with retired general and hope to glean some insights from them.
Your perception on that, Larry, we know that Mertz was in the United States talking with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump referred to the conflict in Ukraine as the conflict between the two kids. And yeah, they're fighting each other. They're going to get tired of this fight, and they're going to find, they're going to, eventually they want to put an end to the conflict, but that's not the case with Russia and Ukraine.
No, the United States, we're like the guy that's the arsonist, and we're standing outside a house that's on fire, and we're trying to pretend that it was the people inside who were smoking in bed that set the house on fire, and that's not the case. They didn't smoke. You know, the United States is the one that provoked this war. And it really goes back 30 years with the continued buildup of NATO and the increased use of annual military exercises, particularly under Donald Trump. You know, when Donald Trump was president, the number, you know, they went from like 3 to 4 military exercises with NATO a year to over 5 per year. And a lot of these exercises entailed offensive military operations. So, you know, Donald Trump is as culpable as anybody for this war. And, you know, that's part of the problem. He likes to pretend that he's had nothing to do with it, and he, you know, doesn't know why they're fighting.
Yeah. Larry, when they think of Europe today, do they see that they're feeling some sort of, that they can get some sort of cooperation with Europe if some sort of Ukrainian settlement happens in the near future? How do they feel about Europe? And I'm not talking about European countries. I'm not just single out in the Hungary or Slovakia. I'm talking about the bigger picture of Europe. How do they feel? Do they really feel that they want to get closer to Europe, or maybe have some sort of relationship, or they're feeling the future, as you've mentioned, they're talking about the future of Russia. How do they see the future? The future is toward the east or toward the west or somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, you know, if you would have asked that question 2 years ago or in 2022, I think you'd find that the Russians were still oriented towards Europe. But I think what has happened over the course of the last 3 years, since the start of the special military operation, the Russians are increasingly looking not just to the east and to China, but south to India and to Iran. You know, Russia's in the process of building that north-south transportation corridor. Which is going to be a significant economic impact. And then you have China doing the Belt and Road Initiative and moving also, just had the first train drive from China to Iran, to Kazakhstan. So, I think the Russians have come to realize that the future lies with the South. And frankly, that's where the majority of people in the world are. It's not the United States and certainly not Western Europe. I heard a statistic yesterday that Namibia itself is the size of the entire Western Europe. Think about that in South Africa. So the global South is the future, and West, particularly Europe, is becoming increasingly irrelevant.
Larry, as we were so much optimistic about Donald Trump before, and right now it doesn't seem that much coming out of the Trump administration to end the conflict in Ukraine. What is the perception of these people who are participating in the conference about Donald Trump and his role in the future and the way that he's trying to move the United States somehow toward pivot from Europe to China? Is he, do they talk about these things, about the Trump's agenda policy?
I participated on a panel today with Sergey Lavrov. And, you know, at least the Russians are happy that they can at least talk to the Americans. Because under Joe Biden, there was no communication at all. Which, you know, when you think back to the darkest days of the Cold War, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during the war in Vietnam, for God's sake, we even back then, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, even Ronald Reagan, we talked to the Russians. There was communication. There was, and that disappeared under Joe Biden. It's now back under Donald Trump, and so the Russians, they're happy about that. That's seen as a step in the right direction. But still, you know, Trump, I don't think, comes across as reassuring or ultra very reliable, because he keeps saying some crazy things from time to time. And, you know, the Russians just say, well, you know, it's almost like they're treating Donald Trump like he's crazy young. You know, Uncle Remus, he says the craziest stuff. That's Donald Trump.
The solution would be on the battlefield, or they still think that they can get something with Donald Trump? As you mentioned, they're optimistic about the way that they're capable to talk, at least with Donald Trump and his administration. But the outcome would be much more important. The outcome, what would that be in their mind?
They definitely don't want to settle things on the battlefield. I mean, that's the absolute last option. You know, it's like, you know, as a firearms instructor, when I teach people self-defense, the very last thing you ever want to do is have to pull out a gun and shoot somebody. So you better make sure that if you're doing that, if your life is in danger, and that if you don't act, you will die or somebody else will die. Well, the Russians approach these conflicts in the world in the same way. And unless they feel that they're absolutely cornered with no way out, and their only option is to fight back, you know, they're gonna find some other way to try to solve these problems. And it's incumbent upon the United States, in my view, to try to act with some maturity and judgment to seek an accommodation with Russia. You know, the United States and Russians are their natural allies, should be, at least on paper. And there's a lot that the United States can learn from Russia. You know, Russia as a multi-ethnic country has learned how to deal with that level of diversity without creating division. They've in fact created unity. And even these different diverse ethnic groups strongly identify as being Russian, including Muslims. So, you know, that's something that the United States can learn. The other thing that's sort of unique about Russia is they are a genuinely colorblind society. They don't look at people with darker skin as somehow innately inferior or subhuman, which unfortunately has been a tendency among the Europeans and among North Americans, that just we've had a racialized past. So, you know, taking those lessons from Russia, I believe, would be beneficial to the West.
Maybe that's why they want to destroy Russia, Larry, because they see how the society is successful under the current administration, under the Putin administration, and how successful he was during many years at Russia, coming from nothing to what Russia is today. It's unbelievable. And they're not happy with that, Larry. They're not happy. Well, they're trying to do everything. You look at Syria, you look at the Middle East, how they can bring that to Russia, how they can turn Ukraine in a terrorist state that can bring some sort of harm to Russia. It's all about Russia and the unity of the country.
Well, the Russian attitudes here are they're pretty optimistic, and it is, you know, you go back and look at in 1925, I think the literacy rate in Russia was 25%. In 1955, that literacy rate was over 90%. So even though they lived under a communist regime, even the communists knew how to educate people. And when you compare what's going on in the United States today, the United States literacy rate is now 79% as of 2024. Russia's is 97, 98%. China's well over 95%. The United States is 70, you know, not even 80%. And then to top it off, the statistics show that over 50% of people that are literate read at a sixth grade level or lower. Well, that means you don't have any real good, solid critical thinking skills. So there's a, if you will, there's an educational gap opening up between China and Russia on the one hand and the United States on the other. The United States falling far, far behind. And we are so arrogant in the United States that we think we're the best, we're the smartest. And yet, you know, the number of our people that speak a foreign language very small, you know, that grow up speaking English and learn to speak another language. Yeah, you have a lot of people that, you know, speak Spanish because, you know, they're illegal immigrants and they're living here and they haven't learned English. That's a different issue. Russia and China are modern. They're modernizing in a way that is leaving the United States in the dust. And it is something that the United States just doesn't appreciate is happening.
You mentioned that the government in Kiev is not capable of paying the families of soldiers to bring the bodies back in Ukraine. What do we know about the aids from the United States or from Europeans? Not only the money, but also the weapons that are going to Ukraine. What is the situation of the Ukrainian army today? We know that Russia is advancing on the battlefield.
Yeah, well, I mean, Russia is all along the line of contact. Russian forces are advancing. And with each advance, they are inflicting more casualties on the Ukrainians. And, you know, this is just Ukraine suffering unsustainable losses. I don't know. There's going to become a breaking point. I don't know when that will be, but it's not going to be 2 or 3 years down the line. It's going to be much quicker than that. Ukraine cannot sustain this kind of operational activity and still keep effective forces on the battlefield. It's just not possible. And the Russians understand that. And so they're increasing the pressure from a military standpoint that ultimately Ukraine's going to collapse.
And do they talk about the buffer zone, Larry, there? Have you heard anybody talking about the buffer zone and how long, how big that would be?
Well,
I'm talking about military buffer zone. I know that Russia wants all of Ukraine to be a buffer zone.
So the last round of peace talks in Istanbul, Medinsky, I believe, presented Umarov, the defense minister, with sort of a final, this is your final offer, Ukraine, take it or leave. Ukraine rejected the offer. So I think the next step for Russia will be capturing all the territory that's east of the Dnieper River, down south, taking Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnipropetrovsk, Poltava, Sumy, Kharkiv, all of this ultimately, I think, is going to fall into the control of Russia. And Ukraine will be without, and it will not have access anymore to the Black Sea. That's where this is headed.
As you mentioned, Russia right now is in a very better position and situation on the battlefield. But when do they really? Is there some sort of concern about Europeans getting involved with the troops on the ground in Ukraine, as the army in Ukraine is going to collapse? As you mentioned, they're not going to sustain this situation that they're experiencing right now. There has to be, on the part of European, as the situation is getting more desperate, what would they do? Are they prepared? Or do they really think that Europeans would be more involved in Ukraine?
The Europeans are good at talking about, but their ability to do anything is very limited. I liken them to, I love the image of the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, because the Black Knight is this character who gets into a fight with one of the Knights of the Round Table, and they cut off both of his arms, both of his legs, so he's on the ground. All he can move is his mouth. That's Europe. All they can move is their mouth. They don't have troops. They don't have industrial capability to produce any weapons of any consequence. So all they can do is talk and make threats. But if they're foolish enough to deploy any forces into Ukraine, they're not. And, Russia's going to kill them. It's that simple.
Larry, how about the new president in Poland? Because the right wing came to somehow in, we had in France, in Germany, right now in Poland, the people had some sort of hope that these new leaders could bring some sort of change, some changes to the policy, to the foreign policy of the countries. That isn't the case when it comes to Europe, European countries who are mostly involved in the conflict in Ukraine. On the part of Russians, in your opinion, do they really think that they can get somehow a better relationship with Slovakia? I don't know if there is somebody from Slovakia there in the conference right now, from Hungary. Are they inviting these people to participate in these sort of conferences, that they get more involved to know more about what's going on in Russia?
No. I think the Russian attitude towards Europe is they don't care much anymore. Europe is no longer of interest. What does Europe have to offer? Yeah, I mean, Russia doesn't need a damn thing from Europe. Not one thing. What is it that Slovakia is going to offer to Russia? Or Poland? Or Germany? France? I mean, Russia doesn't need anything from those countries. They would like to have normal relations. But those countries are driven by an obsessive hatred of Russia. It's just, it's crazy. And, I think the Russians are as puzzled by it, because it's like, what the hell did we do? They've tried to have productive relationships, and instead they've met with nothing but unrelenting hostility for 30 years.
Whenever the Russian president Vladimir Putin was talking about Ukraine, they said that the reason, one of the main reasons of this special military operation, they didn't go to war, as Maria Zakharova said, that they're not just destroying everything. They're just fighting the war with the government in Kiev. But
let me stop you there. So understand the difference between special military operation, counterterrorism operation, and full-scale war. With the special military operation, it's very, very limited mobilization. It's not really mobilization at all. There are financial incentives to sign people up into the military ranks. But there are limits on the kind of targets that are attacked. There are specific limits on going after political or military leadership, if you will, assassinations. Now that, based upon what President Putin said following the attacks of over a week ago in Kursk and the attack on the airfields, Russia has shifted to a counterterrorism operation, which means that now leadership, Zelensky, Sirsky, the general, Budnov, the head of intelligence, military intelligence, can be targets now. Russia will expand its, will escalate its, the types and nature of the attacks. This still falls short of war. Under a state of war, Russian society would be completely mobilized. All reserves would be called into active duty. Satellites that are NATO would be shot down. They would be, I mean, we're trying to be total war. And that, they're not anywhere near that yet. So that's what people in the West need to understand.
But did Ukrainians create some sort of hatred within the Russian society that they can say the public opinion says, we not our brothers anymore. They're changing their attitude. They're doing something so bad that we cannot ignore. With the terrorist attacks I'm talking about.
No, well, you know, there was this last series of attacks really evoked a lot of anger. And but you saw, you know, President Putin himself. If you watched his speech, I described his approach as cold fury. He was very angry. And I'm sure that when he talked to President Trump, that same anger was conveyed to Trump. You know, Trump can paint it as nice as he'd like to, but I think Putin delivered a very strong, direct message to him. So, you know, this, I think what we're witnessing is now the end stages of this war. You know, whether it lasts another month or another 6 months. I don't think we'll be looking at Ukraine as being able to sustain a force in the field come December. And now that I make that prediction, people say, see, you were wrong. Okay.
Yeah. Larry, can you imagine? Donald Trump said that his analogy about fighting two kids fighting each other, he said that to Vladimir Putin. Can you imagine what was the reaction from Vladimir Putin when he heard about that? He said, do you really think that we're
Well, again, it's just, you know, it's when Trump says things like that alarms me, because it shows just how divorced from reality is about the nature of this war. You know, that he thinks this is some beef between Ukraine and Russia without even comprehending that this is a war that has been provoked by the United States and by NATO. And they were using Ukraine simply as a proxy. And as a result, good God, you know, an estimated 1.5 million Ukrainian men have died in this war. It's got awful.
Do they want, Larry, do you feel about the way that they were talking about the government in Kiev and Zelensky, the future of Zelensky and his administration in Ukraine? How is it going to change in the mind of Russian, who has already changed their mindset towards Zelensky? And in what sense has it changed, if that changed? And do they want Zelensky? Do they see Zelensky as somebody who can negotiate, who can talk?
No. So he can't negotiate with Zelensky. He has no legitimacy. Let's say he agreed to everything that the Russians asked for. he's not in a position to sign an agreement that the Russians would consider legitimate, simply because he's no longer the legal president of Ukraine.
Yeah, because right now they have no option but negotiating with the current government in Kiev. I think they need to explain that to Donald Trump and whoever is behind Zelensky, that with Zelensky and his administration, there is no future with the talks that are happening right now between Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Zelensky doesn't benefit from any sort of Ukrainian settlement.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, and Zelensky's not even willing to negotiate in good faith. Like I said, Russia's made a decision. They'll negotiate at a working level. They'll negotiate on technical details, such as release of POWs, return of cadavers. But in terms of big issues, that's done. They recognize, as Vladimir Putin said, these are terrorists. You don't negotiate with terrorists.
We had Israeli ambassador to Kiev. He says that Israel has quietly transferred Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. And that shows how the two conflicts in the Middle East and in Russia, in Ukraine, are related to each other. And they can feed each other. And even the situation with Syria. How in the future that they're talking about, in the future of Russia that they're talking about right now at the conference, how do they see the relationship with Iran, with China, and the future of Middle East? And how important is the future of Middle East, or the future of the case of Taiwan, for Russia?
Well, you know, Russia has already made its decision with the signing of the Comprehensive Security Agreement with Iran on January 17th. So Russia is in partnership with Iran. You know, it's important to recognize what happened back in 2018, that was a pivotal year in which both Russia and China recognized that continued normal relationships with Washington were actually unlikely. And that's when they began planning, and they conducted the first joint military naval exercise with Iran in March of 2019. So the once it became apparent that the West was no longer a reliable negotiating partner, China and Russia changed their position. And now, you know, Iran is in a much stronger position than it ever has been in the last 10 years. And all of that is due because of its new economic and political relationships with Russia and China.
How about the security, Larry? How about the cooperation, military and security cooperation with China? Do they talk about it? Do they know to what extent they want to participate, to what extent they want to be closer to China? Is there any sort of limitation on their part, or they're just saying that whatever that would be, our future is together. That's why we have to go to the as great as we can to get somehow some sort of cooperation between the two countries.
No, I think, you know, well, China and Russia recognize that Iran is going to play a critical role in the future of their economic development. Iran will be a crucial transfer point both from east to west, as well as from north to south. That was the purpose the other day when the Chinese train made its way from China through Kazakhstan into Tehran. And, you know, then the transportation that's going to take place from north to south. So, you know, I think both China and Russia recognize the future of the world economically lies in part with Iran, not with the West.
And the combination of people who are participating in this conference, Larry, who are, they're mostly from Europe, they're mostly from Russia, China, from Middle East, from the West Asia. How do you see the combination of these people who are participating at the conference right now?
I have run into Russians who came from California, people from Spain, people from Italy. So they're from all over. I didn't, you know, I was at the International Russophile Movement Conference a year ago, February. And there was an enormous representation of both Africans, South Americans, and Asians. Not so much at this one now. This is primarily a Russian crowd, a European crowd. But, you know, still is a professor, a distinguished professor from Fudan University in Shanghai, Professor Wei Wei. He's here. And there's another distinguished academic out of India, Professor Atul. So, you know, I'm meeting up with some old, well, I call them new old friends.
If the United States decides to go with the plan of sanctions that they're talking about right now in the United States on Russia and intensifying the sanctions on Russia, the main fear, in my opinion, would be from India and the way that the United States would be able to somehow separate India from Russia. Is that the same perception on the part of Russians?
Okay, say that again. I'm not sure I follow you.
The perception on the part of Russians in terms of American sanctions on Russia. How the main fear of the sanction is coming from the way that the United States is capable of putting pressure on Russia, on India?
Well, look, I think, again, Russia doesn't need anything from the United States. What Russia would like from the United States is that they're not in a competition that could lead to nuclear war. And so looking for assurances that both sides will behave responsibly. Again, remember, it's been the United States, not Russia, that's walked away from every major nuclear agreement, starting, you know, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty Agreement in 2001 by George W. Bush, and then Donald Trump walking away from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement in 2018. You know, Russia hasn't walked away. It's been the United States. So to that extent, I believe that, you know, Russia would like to see the United States be a more reliable negotiating partner. So far, we've not been that.
One of the problems that many people are talking about in the United States is the concern about that that Donald Trump is not receiving properly the intelligence from Tulsi Gabbard, those people who are responsible to brief him. Do you feel that the intelligence that he's receiving, the lack of, I don't know, the information that he's getting from the intelligence is one of the main issues with the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine, for example?
Look, I do not believe that Tulsi Gabbard is withholding intelligence from him. So if Donald Trump is not taking the briefings, is not listening to what's being presented to him, it's his fault. It's not Tulsi's. Tulsi's got the responsibility to deliver the presidential daily brief. The reports are that Trump is not, he may get it once a week. He's not relying upon that. It's J.D. Vance that's getting it. So if that's the case, shame on Trump. You know, he's ignoring a valuable resource that can help him in his presidency.
Yeah, the problem is that it shows that he doesn't have the access to the alternative media, at least to see the both sides of the aisle, to see, to compare them. This is the problem, in my opinion. Do you feel that if he's not interested in the intelligence, he doesn't have time to listen to the alternative media, that would change, that would somehow put pressure on him?
Well, he has the time. He just doesn't, he chooses not to take the time. That's the problem. If he's declining these briefings, if he's not taking the briefings, if he's ignoring the briefings, that's on him, not on anybody else. And like I said, if that's the case, shame on him.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. I know that you're there and you have to do your job there, and you're so. And yeah, we're going to see you on Friday in Florida. Is that right?
Yes, I'll be there.
Yeah, have a great time there, Larry.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye.